Welcome to the REWARC Primary Review, where we cover the latest developments in high yield, distressed debt, and bankruptcy, and feature discussions on issues affecting distressed debt, leveraged finance, direct lending, high yield bonds, high yield municipals, covenants, private credit, and middle market companies. I'm David Zupkis. This week, REWARC Senior Primary Market Reporter Michael Haley speaks with Andre Skiba, Managing Director and Head of U.S. Fixed Income at RBC Global Asset Management, about what dynamics will impact the leveraged finance market in 2024. The episode includes Skiba's views on how healthy market conditions will hold up for the rest of the year for leveraged loans and high-yield bonds, as well as what will happen with defaults moving forward. And as always, we bring you our weekly summary of interesting developments in the restructuring world, as well as a preview of what's on tap for next week. We'd love to hear your feedback to help us improve the podcast experience, so please take a moment to complete the short survey at the link attached to this podcast and let us know how we're doing. It's Monday, March 25th.
Welcome back to another episode of the REWARC Primary Review podcast, where we bring you informed insights on critical issues in the leveraged finance and distressed markets. My name is Michael Haley, Senior Primary Market Reporter at REWARC, and I'm pleased to have Andre Skiba of RBC Global Asset Management with me today to discuss dynamics playing out in the leveraged finance market. Andre is the Managing Director and Head of U.S. Fixed Income at RBC Global Asset Management, and looks at a range of different fixed income investments. Welcome, Andre.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So, Andre, as the first quarter of 2024 is drawing to a close, we've seen conditions in the market significantly tighten while issuers continue to conduct refinance activity, especially so in the leveraged loan market as opposed to the high-yield bond market. Primary deals funding M&A and LBO activity has been moderate so far this year, yet it is expected to pick up looking ahead to the rest of the year. Still, market participants continue to have concerns surrounding inflation and its impact on corporate issuance. So while market conditions feel healthy right now in the leveraged finance markets, what impact does the threat of inflation hold on new primary issuance looking ahead towards the rest of the year?
From our perspective, this is as much a question about inflation as much as it is a question about the pace of rate cuts that Fed could engineer. Because it is clear that if inflation does not cooperate, the ability of the Fed to cut three times this year, three times next year and beyond will be diminished. And in that environment, we would not only expect less M&A activity, so you would expect fewer leverage buyout transactions happening, but also broader sentiment towards leverage finance assets to worsen ahead, particularly in the case of lower rated issuers and those in direct lending space where the current funding costs are elevated. The prospect of higher for longer rates could be a major issue ahead.
Thank you, Andre. So how are fixed income investors feeling about fixed rate versus floating rate debt right now as conditions feel tighter than the start of the year? Have views on exposure to floating rate debt changed at all in the past year?
In reality, we're seeing healthy demand across both floating and fixed rate debt. From a floating rate perspective, what investors like is the fact that yields that you can lock in at current times are looking much more interesting within the floating rate debt space than for US high yield. Having said that, those investors who do anticipate a lot of rate cuts ahead really want to have exposure to the convexity of the asset class, and that's what US high-yield bonds provide. So essentially, you have to choose a camp, whether you are within that group of investors that expects higher for longer. And in that group, broadly syndicated loans could look like a really good investment over the coming quarters compared to those who see multiple rate cuts ahead and want to benefit from the convexity of the bond asset class.
Interesting. Thank you, Andre. Next, I'd like to get your thoughts on defaults. Even with the primary market feeling more optimistic right now than, say, last year, How do you see default rates holding up for the rest of the year?
So right now we see defaults in around 3% range. And we would expect that number to move up a little bit as the year progresses, but only marginally. For as long as the US economy is doing well, and for as long as the US consumer remains in pretty good shape, we would not expect to see a meaningful move higher in default rates. What has been unusual over the recent quarters is the fact that the default rate for bonds is actually lower than that for loans or within private credit and direct lending specifically. And that really reflects greater use of leverage within those spaces and capital structures that are suffering from a high cost of funding, given that they are floating at this point in time. But for as long as US economy behaves, and that is our base case scenario, we would struggle to see default rates moving any close to 5%. And we see that reflected in a broadly positive sentiment towards leveraged finance asset class that we witness amongst investors right now.
Great. Thank you, Andre. Recently, it feels like the leveraged loan primary market has been hot with a wave of new issuers coming to borrow. Yet it seems like private credit lenders are still vying for the interest of that part of the market. What is your outlook on private credit lenders competing for this space in the primary market? Are we going to see more of these lenders in deals for the rest of the year?
Well, it's been fascinating to watch the tussle between broadly syndicated loan market and private credit space, direct lending in particular. You know, we've been used in the bond space of a shrinking market for quite some time now. And a lot of that was happening at the expense of growth within the leveraged loan space. But last year, for the first time in quite a long time, it's the leveraged loan market that shrank because a lot of refinancing has been moving towards direct lending opportunities. And clearly, direct lending investment firms have raised a lot of funding, have raised a lot of assets from investors over the recent years. And as you can imagine, they're very keen to put that money to work. But what has happened in recent times is that as investors are desperate to put money to work, they are accepting lower and lower margins. So the gap between the broadly syndicated market and the direct lending space is actually narrowing quite considerably. And the side effect of that is a greater ability of the broadly syndicated market to compete. And we've actually seen quite a number of transactions recently where it became a much better deal for the companies to refinance in the leveraged loan market rather than in the private credit space. So we would expect that tussle to continue, but the end result of it being that the margins at which deals are pricing within private credit space are likely to shrink further and start converging towards what we see in the leverage loan space. So for now, the broadly syndicated market is trying to fight back and is being quite successful given a better market sentiment and a backdrop of lower margins within the space.
That relationship is definitely going to be interesting to keep track of for the rest of the year. So looking ahead to the rest of 2024, the market is pricing in 3 interest rate cuts from the Fed. Given this, how are market participants on the buy side looking at new primary issuance differently? Is the buy side more selective when it comes to getting involved in new deals?
It really depends. In the bond market, we have seen limited discipline from clients. People are so keen to put money to work after almost absence of primary issuance within U.S. high-yield bond space, that we see repeated examples of multiple times oversubscribed books with final pricing significantly inside initial whispers. So it does not feel right now like investors are really being picky with opportunities within U.S. high-yield bond space. From our perspective as active investors, of course, our objective is to be much more selective, and rather than following the herd, pick those opportunities that still leave value on the table. But almost every single time we're facing heavily oversubscribed deals within U.S. high-yield bond space. And the fact of the matter is, even though supply picked up a bit year-to-date, it's still significantly lower than in the heyday of 2020 and 2021 when we have really active U.S. high-yield bond market. Within leveraged loan space, we've also seen a really interesting dynamic with an almost overwhelming wave of repricings for existing deals. And a lot of the primary market activity was actually to do with issuers trying to take advantage of better economic conditions and better market sentiment to reprice deals by often 50 basis points or more within the market. And that has really consumed a lot of activity. And we've actually started seeing some pushback from investors to the degree of changing the pricing on those facilities. We have also seen a fair amount of transactions within the leveraged loan space that are helping to fund dividend distributions. Again, with the market more comfortable with the growth outlook in the US, we're also seeing greater acceptance of funding distributions within the leveraged loan space. Those have attracted decent interest as well, because they give opportunity to gain exposure to those companies that are doing well in the current environment. So leveraged loan space has been busy, but for different reasons than we've seen in the U.S. high-yield bond space. And we would not really expect this dynamic to change in any dramatic fashion over the coming months, because you still have money coming into the high-yield bond space, so investors keen to put money to work, while in the leveraged loan space, the ARB is really favorable for further CLO creation. So the demand from CLO investors will remain robust over the coming months. Of course, what would change that outlook was either much worse outlook for inflation and necessary changes in terms of Fed policy. But as we've seen in Chair Powell's latest press conference, he was at pains to make sure not to sound hawkish in any way. So for now, the music is clearly playing.
That's great to hear, Andre. So to finish up, I'd love to get your thoughts on what the leveraged finance market looks like for the rest of the year.
Well, when we're speaking to potential investors, everyone is hoping for a better entry point. Everyone is grumbling about the level of valuations after the recent rally. But in fairness, we do expect current conditions to continue. If inflation cooperates, Fed cuts rates, and U.S. economy does not tilt towards a recession and remains in a positive growth territory, we would expect more and more money coming into fixed income, including leverage finance, as investors are keen to lock in the yields before they decline further. So from a spread perspective, that could mean wider spreads, but purely because the treasury yields would decline. While in total return terms, we see strong positive total return ahead, And it's not that difficult to create a scenario where even in U.S. high-yield bond space on a forward-looking 12-month basis, you see double-digit returns ahead. And this kind of an environment is normally characterized by fair value assets becoming outright expensive. So it's clearly an interesting challenge for active investors like ourselves to find pockets of value within the market where we do not have to compromise on valuations. But the backdrop remains very positive for the asset class, and the technical support for the market also remains strong. So we are hoping for better entry points, but as long as U.S. economy cooperates and Fed does not change its direction of travel, it might be difficult to find periods of major dislocation ahead. And that's why, rather than losing carry, losing return from being invested, we suggest to our clients of having some exposure to the asset class.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Andre. It was a pleasure to have you on REORP's Primary View podcast.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
For in-court coverage this week, we take a look at Joanne Stores, Endo International, Robert Shaw, Genesis Global, Kaiser Gypsum, Puerto Rico, Voyager Aviation, and the latest in the Judge David Jones scandal out of the Southern District of Texas. Fabrics and crafts retailer Joanne Stores filed Chapter 11 on Monday in the bankruptcy court for the District of Delaware, touting a transaction support agreement with more than 80% of term loan holders, more than 66% of existing equity interest holders in debtor Joanne Inc., and certain third-party financing parties. Before the filing, debtors began soliciting votes on a prearranged plan that would slash total funded debt by about $504.7 million by equitizing pre-petition term loan obligations and either refinancing or continuing pre-petition ABL and first and last out term loan facilities. At the first day hearing on Tuesday, Judge Craig Goldblatt authorized the debtors to access a $142 million dip-to-exit financing facility and use cash collateral both on an interim basis. Interim relief included a $95 million new money draw and a bespoke provision under which $25 million of trade payables will convert into DIP term loans. Judge Goldblatt also approved Joanne's proposed confirmation timeline, scheduling the confirmation hearing for April 25th. Judge James Garrity confirmed the Endo International debtors' plan on Tuesday, overruling objections lodged by a Quebec class action plaintiff and pro se claimants. The plan provides first lien creditors with 96.3% of equity in a parent entity formed to acquire the debtor's assets, while second lien creditors and unsecured note holders would share 3.7% of the new equity, both subject to dilution by the $340 million first lien and $160 million GUC rights offerings, related premiums, and a 4.5% equity management incentive plan. At a hearing on Thursday, Judge Christopher Lopez approved Robert Shaw's $56 million dip facility and bidding procedures after the debtors reached a last-minute resolution of objections filed by former first-in-last-out controlling lender Invesco. The debtors filed revised proposed orders just before the hearing, adding language reserving the parties' rights in litigation over the December 2023 Invesco payoff transaction. The sale timeline approved by Judge Lopez includes a May 3rd bid deadline and an auction of no later than May 7th. Unlike the debtor settlement with the ad hoc group of excluded lenders that challenged the company's May 2023 up-tier exchange, the Invesco deal is not a global resolution, and Invesco's suit to unwind the December 2023 payoff of its first-out loans and restore its required lender status could still upset the case. The Genesis Global Holdco debtors sought court approval of a previously announced settlement with Gemini Trust Company, the ad hoc group of Genesis lenders, and the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors. The deal would resolve all Gemini-related issues in the Chapter 11 cases, including litigation over valuation of the Gemini earn user's deficiency claim and lender's entitlement to proceeds of collateral securing the Gemini earn program loans after Gemini's purported pre-petition foreclosure of Grayscale Bitcoin Trust shares. The debtors say that the settlement paves the way to near-term recoveries of approximately 97% on an in-kind basis to the Gemini lenders, and Gemini calls the agreement the best and only path to a near-term coin-for-coin recovery for the Gemini lenders. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Tuesday in Truck Insurance Exchange versus Kaiser Gypsum Company. The asbestos bankruptcy case on appeal from the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Fourth Circuit asks whether an insurer with financial responsibility for a bankruptcy claim is a party in interest under Section 1109B of the Bankruptcy Code that may object to a Chapter 11 plan. The Supreme Court gave no indication as to the timing of a decision taking the matter under advisement. The confirmation trial, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority's plan of adjustment, concluded on Monday after the plan's supporters and detractors presented closing arguments to Judge Laura Taylor Swain. Certain unions and bondholders, including Assured Guarantee, Golden Tree Asset Management, Syncora Guarantee, the PREPA Ad Hoc Group, and Bond Trustee U.S. Bank, opposed confirmation over 11 days of trial. Judge John Mustando III confirmed the Voyager Aviation debtors' plan at a hearing on Wednesday, overruling the sole remaining objection from MUFG-MSN Fortune 32 aircraft lenders. Judge Mustando ruled that the MUFG lenders are not entitled to post-petition default interest of $164,000 and that the debtors are entitled to offset an approximately $1.1 million swap breakage credit against amounts owed to the lenders. Kirkland & Ellis and former Jackson Walker partner Elizabeth Freeman moved to dismiss a lawsuit filed by Michael Van Dielen, who accuses them of conspiring to profit from Freeman's undisclosed relationship with former Judge David R. Jones in violation of the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. Kirkland argues that Van Dielen carelessly accused Kirkland of engaging in criminal misconduct without doing basic due diligence and asked the court to impose sanctions on the plaintiff and his counsel. In her motion, Freeman denies that Kirkland or Jackson Walker violated disclosure requirements under Rule 2014 of the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure. Aventiv, Dish, EchoStar, City Brewing, RDog, and Cumulus Media ran out this week's crop of near-term restructurings and refinancings and new advisor mandates. Aventiv, formerly known as Securus Technologies, has cleansed materials associated with a transaction to sell the business and a potential toggle to a restructuring later this year. The provider of telecom services to correctional facilities has until the fourth quarter of 2024 to pursue a sale process, the sources said. If there's no bid or the purchase price does not cover the first lien debt, and if the terms are not satisfactory to the first lien lenders who decide not to proceed with the sale, the company will have to file Chapter 11 or restructure out of court to equitize debt and let lenders take over, the sources say. REERC published an analysis last week suggesting that it's likely that the combined Dish and EchoStar have looked to legacy EchoStar's liquidity, which stood at $2.2 billion as of September 30, 2023, to fund Dish Network Corp's 2024 cash burn, including its 5G network capital expenditures and operating costs, as well as a repayment of $951 million of 2.375% convertible notes that matured on Friday, March 15th. The analysis also discusses the potential for EchoStar to explore a path to purchase T-Mobile's megahertz spectrum and a strategy to coercively address its convertible notes. To access REERC's full analysis in more detail, please reach out to a REERC representative. RDog is working with an investment banker to explore liability management options for nearly $8 billion of debt maturing in the next 3 years. After the news of the company's mandate, REERC learned that an ad hoc group of crossover noteholders is organizing with Milbank as legal advisor, and an ad hoc group of secured creditors represented by Gibson Dunn as counsel is working with Perella Weinberg Partners as investment banker. According to sources, Cumulus Media has enlisted an investment banker to advise in its capital structure and engage with lenders and noteholders on maturities. Also, according to sources, City Brewing is working with Evercore as investment banker to explore balance sheet options and address potential covenant breach. Top red stories this week included liability management becomes creditor-on-creditor violence in the U.S., creditors become debtors in Europe, China Vanke onshore loan talks lend optimism, McKinsey defendants seek to dismiss J. Alex bankruptcy disclosure litigation, allege Alex is not real party in interest. Hudson settles LATAM aircraft auction suit against Ares Wilmington Trust. And now here's Kate Thomas from New York with The Week Ahead.
Welcome to The Week Ahead. My name is Kate Thomas, and here are a few highlights from the upcoming week. A longer schedule of events can be found under America's Week Ahead on the REERC website. After five adjournments for undisclosed reasons, the Rite Aid debtors are again scheduled to seek conditional approval of their disclosure statement on Monday, over objections from the U.S. trustee and the state of Maryland. The debtors have been locked in mediation with their ad hoc noteholder group, which does not support the plan, and last month, the debtors adjourned their auction for retail assets indefinitely. Also Monday, the SEC's fraud trial against Terraform Labs kicks off. In the complaint, the SEC charges Terraform and CEO Do Kwon with orchestrating a multi-billion dollar securities fraud scheme, leading to at least $40 billion of losses for U.S. retail and institutional investors. Terraform Labs developed the Terra blockchain and marketed and sold its own digital assets, which are the focus of the SEC's complaint. Late last year, U.S. District Court Judge Jed Rakoff ruled that Terraform digital assets are securities and granted summary judgment on several counts. However, Judge Rakoff left three fraud counts against TerraForm and its CEO for this week's trial. Then on Wednesday, the FTX group debtors will be in court seeking approval of their global settlement with the BlockFi wind-down debtors. The settlement, which received no objections, resolves BlockFi's asserted $1 billion of claims in the FTX cases and various unliquidated litigation claims asserted between the two estates. Then on Thursday, Sam Bankman-Fried's sentencing hearing is set to go forward. Last November, Bankman-Fried was convicted on seven counts, including securities fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy. Prosecutors are seeking to put Bankman-Fried behind bars for at least 40 years. Lastly, MBK Farmco has a confirmation hearing on Wednesday for its liquidating plan. The debtors filed bankruptcy to pursue a going concern sale or a reorganization through an equitizing plan, but switched to a wind down of operations when they only received a $275 million joint credit bid from pre-petition lenders. According to a voting declaration filed last week, all voting classes voted to accept the plan. That's it for now. For more on the week ahead, check out America's Week Ahead on the REORG website and have a great week.
Thank you again for tuning in to the REORG Primary Review and our weekly review. Find all our podcasts on the REORG.com webinars and podcast page, as well as Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Amazon. Take care and see you all next week.